meeting of the House Fisheries Committee to order. The time is 11:02 a.m. Members present at this time, Representative Kevin McCabe, Representative Sarah Vance, Representative Andy Story, Representative Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, Representative Dan Ortez, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. My first committee hearing in the room here, so it's nice to be back. Members, a couple reminders to please silence your cell phones. If you need to pass a note, please get the attention of our committee aide, Thatcher Brower. Thank you to Shannon McCade, our committee secretary. Thank you. And Talia Eames, I hope I'm saying that right, from the Juno LIO for their support. Thank you both so much. We just have one item on our agenda today. It's House Bill 82, Gas Leases Renewable Energy. We did hear this bill last year. Now that it's been many months in between, figuring people may need a bit of a refresher. And what we wanted to do was have the bit of refresher and allow for questions to be asked. This bill is also being heard in the other body, so there's, you know, movement happening on this legislation. We don't have any plans to move it today or, you know, even set an amendment deadline or anything like that. But what had happened in the last committee hearing at the end of last session was we ran out of time to get all the questions answered. So we at least want to get through that, you know, refresh your presentation, get questions answered, and then we'll evaluate what our next steps are. So if that sounds okay to everyone, we have a few folks here to present. Aaron Quinn, Petroleum Land Manager from DNR. Haley Payne, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas from DNR, is on the phone. And then Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist, DNR, is also on the phone. So I think we're going to have Mr. O'Quinn come up here first. Is that right? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. And that's O'Quinn, just for the record. Thank you, members of the committee, for having us today. My name is Aaron O'Quinn. I'm a petroleum land manager with the Division of Oil and Gas in the Department of Natural Resources. As an employee of the division, I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill and to talk about some of the impacts that it has on the operations of the Division of Oil and Gas and present the material in a way that can help you to understand how this can make doing business in the state a bit easier. So the main purpose of the bill, of House Bill 82, is to allow the division to lease and capture revenue from state-owned resources. Basically, as it stands now, there is a statute on the books that prevents oil and gas leasing within Kachemak Bay generally. This bill would allow the state to lease the subsurface to an operator through a competitive process allow them to extract that oil and gas either through just drainage by not necessarily going onto that premises or by accessing that premises from the subsurface only. So the status quo would be maintained as far as surface operations. There would be no rigs allowed. There would be no drilling platforms, there would be nothing permitted within the bay itself. All of the hydrocarbon resource would be accessed from off the premises. As it stands now, the operations are conducted on private land near Anchor Point. So that's basically the gist of it. The catch is that if the operator drills onto the currently leased state land near the border with the unleased state land, it may drain the state's resources. And in order to capture that revenue from that resource and allocate its percentage to the state, there would have to be an administrative hearing before the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. It's a big public hearing that would It can take several years to get through that process. And so at this time, that is really the only way that the state would be able to properly allocate its revenue up for that resource extraction. So generally speaking, though, the technology that exists today allows the operator to drill from a surface pad several miles away to the subsurface perhaps beneath Kachemak Bay, perhaps adjacent to Kachemak Bay, but it would allow this bill would alter the ability of the state to lease that property right to the operator, and so that we could properly allocate the production. So again, no surface impacts, no rigs, no drill ships, no seismic in Kachemak Bay, nothing like that would be allowed. No pipelines. It would all basically be operated from the surface on this on land on the surface in the currently opened areas, and the only possible subsurface operations that could occur would be the wellbore passing beneath the bay. Here's an example of how that technology might be implemented. So if you can imagine looking at this diagram, right now, if you were to draw a vertical line from the edge of the water straight up and down, that would be basically the extent to which the wellbore would be allowed to pass. So if an operator drilled all the way to that border, the hydrocarbon resource that exists, underneath the bay would be drawn toward that wellbore by the lower pressure situation, but it wouldn't be under lease, and so there wouldn't be a contractual agreement between the state and the operator as to how the state would be compensated for that, and it would have to go through the administrative process in the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Again, there wouldn't be any surface impacts to the bay itself, but that being said, we do have very strict protections in place for the areas where surface operations are currently allowed. The state, every 10 years, reaches a best interest finding. They look at all of they look at all the facts on the ground. They solicit testimony from the public. They do lots of scientific research, and we make a finding based on whether it is in the best interest of the state to lease land. Within that best interest finding, we adopt mitigation measures, which, and I do have copies of the current mitigation measures for Cook Inlet with me right now for your review if you'd like those. But basically, what it does is it restricts drilling activity within buffer zones around anadromous fish streams. There are a number of environmental protections in those mitigation measures currently that protect the surface area, protect fish, protect wildlife habitat. And then second layer of protection is any surface operations go through a permitting process. So any pipelines that are used for gathering natural gas or oil go through our pipeline section. Any roads that are built go through our permitting section. Just much like on the North Slope, we look at all of the impacts that these operations have on the surface when issuing permits, and then we bond for those sorts of risks to ensure that if something were to happen, it can be protected. This goes back, the royalty distribution slide goes back to kind of something that I started to talk about earlier was, the hydrocarbon exists wherever it exists. It doesn't respect the boundaries that we've placed on the surface of the earth. And disclosure may create a boundary that crosses that hydrocarbon accumulation. And so what this law would allow would be for the state to lease that mineral resource and to reach a contractual agreement with the operator in order to determine how that the state would receive revenue from that extraction. This slide kind of walks through some of the intricacies of how leases are unitized and put into operated under a unit agreement. But generally speaking, you combine a block of leases and you look at where the resource is beneath that block of resources, and each lease gets assigned a percentage. If we can't have a, if we don't have a lease, then we can't assign it a percentage, and that's when we have to go to the AOGCC for a compulsory unit. So again, main concern is collecting the royalties and having that really, really clear and distinct and agreed to method for reaching, you know, for receiving that revenue. The other kind of wild card that the AOGCC process throws into things is that when we aren't leasing it, we can't enforce those mitigation measures that are in our leases upon that operator because they, you know, we don't have that agreement with them. It's whatever the AOGCC decides. And so it's, you know, this just gives a lot more certainty both to the state and to the operator, knowing what their contractual obligations are. We know what protections are in place. They're the protections that we've promulgated through our decision process. And so it really just makes things much more clear, gives a lot more certainty to the state as far as how its revenue would be allocated. And it gives a lot more certainty to the operator, not having to go through this, this kind of long-term administrative process through the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
We have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Couple of questions, if I may.
Sure, of course, yes.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Of course.
And thank you for being with us today and give us a review of a bill that we had previously heard. Couple of questions. Number one, you know, we talk about, we're having this discussion now because of this new technology that's available to go beneath the surface and drill diagonally, I guess. How long has that technology been around, and is there any evidence yet where it's currently being used of there being any problems in terms of leaks, things like that?
As far as the amount for the duration that that technology has been implemented, I can't say exactly, but it's very long standing. It's not the last year or two. It's more like the last 20 to 30 years or something like that. You know, we have on the North Slope, I know an operator is, I think it was a 7 or maybe a 15-mile total wellbore length. You know, we're not talking about the size of that sort of resource here, so this would be not unlikely to be that sort of an operation. But as far as accidents, it's not, and this is more the purview of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to regulate the drilling process. The Division of Oil and Gas manages the proprietary interest, the leasing, that sort of thing. But as far as I know, the well is cased and cemented and operated much the same way that a vertical well bore would be operated. And I don't know of any specific problems related to this sort of horizontal drilling that have occurred.
And as far as you talk about how the passage of this bill would enable the state to capture some royalties from the activity that could potentially take place, are you saying that if this bill were not passed, that the operator could still access areas in terms of, let's say, the Ketchmack Bay area? We wouldn't be able to capture any of the royalties from that unless this bill was passed. In other words, the private operator could still go into these areas that we're talking about and access these resources with or without the passage of this bill. Is that correct?
That's not entirely correct. So without a lease, the operator can't put its well bore onto that specific aerial piece of land, which in this case would be below Ketchmack Bay. But they can go right up to the boundary with it. And when they do that, it creates a low pressure situation. The hydrocarbons will migrate from the high pressure situation in the reservoir to that well bore. So it would drain that land. They wouldn't necessarily have the well drilled on there. That being said, as an employee of the Division of Oil and Gas, I can say that we would take note of that and we would assert our property rights But the only way that we would have to do that, the only means of relief for receiving income from that land would be to go through the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which, as I mentioned earlier, there's a administrative process, and it's cited here on this slide, 3105-100. But basically what that is perhaps I should start at the beginning. The general rule is you drill a well, you get to keep whatever comes through that well bore, even if it's draining someone else's oil and gas. There have been kind of limits to that doctrine of the rule of capture, and one of them is the doctrine of correlative rights, and states have enacted legislation that protects people and ensures that reservoirs are drained efficiently, that everyone gets their sort of fair share of that joint resource. So the only way that the state would be able to receive those royalties would be to go through this administrative process with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, as opposed to if we pass this bill and could lease that land to an operator, then we would have a contractual agreement that says how that royalty would be paid. And just speaking kind of anecdotally, the operators are much more inclined to invest capital if they have the certainty of a contract, as opposed to the wild card of this administrative process for allocating that resource. And additionally, they may want to put their wellbore further on. It may drain the reservoir more efficiently to do that. And so so by passing this bill, the legislature would basically allow that contractual agreement to be put in place, but also possibly allow the reservoir to be drained more efficiently by allowing that wellbore to reach the best part of that reservoir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in your presentation, you intermix, you know, oil and gas lease. Are we talking about the resource here primarily being oil or natural gas that the company would potentially harvest?
So at this point, I'll move to the next slide here and show you guys the area that we're talking about. So this area is adjacent to what is called the Seaview Unit, which is basically in the vicinity of Anchor Point. Currently, the two wells that exist in the Seaview Unit are gas wells, so natural gas, which is the primary source of fuel for the rail belt's electrical needs, and they're accessed from the green pad that you can see kind of in the just below the word Seaview in the map here, or on the map here. So it's primarily natural gas, which basically would be feedstock for utility consumption, so either for electricity or for residential consumer natural gas use.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Of course, Representative Ortiz. And do you want to see, do your colleagues have anything to add to those responses?
By all means, Haley or Sean.
Perhaps not. That's okay, too.
Yeah.
Since they were online. We do also have Dan Seamount, who is one of the commissioners for AOGCC, and then David Roby, Senior Reservoir Engineer at AOGCC.
Great. Thanks for that. And I might defer to them. I'll run through this really quickly. But again, as I said, the contract that we would be allowed to enter into if this bill were to pass would allow us to integrate all those contracts together into one agreement and share that production. If not, it would have to go through the AOGCC, and perhaps Commissioner Seamount could speak to the compulsory unitization process that occurs through the AOGCC. So that's when, you know, they say, okay, this is what the whole oil and gas reservoir looks like. How do we drain this efficiently, and how do we share all that oil and gas with the owners of it in the most equitable manner. And as far as I know, there haven't been any compulsory units formed by the AOGCC ever. I may be misspeaking, but I don't know of any, and perhaps Commissioner Seamount may have something to add there.
Thank you, Mr. O'Quinn. And Mr. Seamount, if you can just hold one second, because we do have a couple members that have questions, and let's get those out there. It may be part of that conversation. First, Representative Price-Tompkins, and then Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions. First is, do you, Mr. O'Quinn, anticipate that passage of this legislation would, I guess, be relevant for any oil and gas development in Alaska outside the Cook Inlet Basin?
I can't think of anything. So the bill does two specific things. It opens up that blue area that was on the map here to subsurface exploration only and development only. And then secondly, it puts in a general provision that would basically allow subsurface development on any area that had been closed surface-wise elsewhere. We looked, we didn't see anything that this would implicate, but it's just designed to kind of do a little bit of housekeeping here. The oil and gas provinces in the state generally on the North Slope are well-developed, and there aren't any areas that I know of where this would apply in Cook Inlet. This is the only place I can think this would apply, and we've kind of specified exactly where it applies to, just this one township. So as far as I know, there's no other specific area that this would apply to.
So as far as, if I understand it, Section 1 that sort of anticipatorily creates a sort of new default statewide, even if there isn't an explicit contemplation of this affecting or relating to development in other parts of Alaska, is it fair to say that's like a, you know, six of one half of a dozen of the other kind of situation? It's not really material to the division's interests because it's just kind of a like anticipatory clause statewide, even though there's no like specific development in mind with Section 1?
That's exactly right. I think we just see that sometimes when there's a surface use restriction, it can create ambiguity about what's allowed on the subsurface, and this is to eliminate that ambiguity that might exist either in the future or that exists currently.
Final follow-up? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the last question I had was, as far as royalties, that being the impetus of this legislation, the state capturing its royalty share, say the bill passes, what is the sort of financial order of magnitude in terms of additional royalty collection that the state might anticipate?
Unfortunately, I don't know the size of the resource that might be exploited there, and I don't know what price that the operator might get for that at this time. So I wouldn't be able to answer that probably very specifically. I'm not sure if there was a fiscal note attached to this bill. I believe there was that may have addressed that, but I don't think it was addressed in any specific terms. And if Sean or Haley have any insights there, I might ask them to weigh in if that's okay with the chair.
Of course, yeah. Mr. Clifton or Ms. Payne, do you want to add anything about the anticipated royalty revenue?
Yes, Chairwoman Tarr, for the record, my name is Haley Payne, Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I'd like to thank again the committee for opportunity to speak today. My apologies, I thought I unmuted at the first opportunity, but must have missed the boat on that one. So to the first question in terms of regarding the royalties, at this point in time, there is not a specific geologic structure that has been clearly mapped in size in terms of understanding what particular reservoir may or may not be there. As this area is currently unleased, there has not been the exploration data brought together in order to bear that specific economic information. Further, as these lands have not been able to be available for a competitive lease sale, we have not yet set what that royalty rate may be. You may see other leases in the Cook Inlet that have a 12.5% royalty, but that may or may not be what the royalty rate would be set at during this process. In addition to royalties, there are other economic factors to consider. The state would then have the ability to collect rentals on these lands, as well as receive bonus bids at the time of lease. So in short answer, while we do not have the figures at this time and would not know until exploration had occurred, we do anticipate that there would be some positive revenue to the state. And just to return to a previous question that Representative Ortiz asked through the chair, in terms of the oil and gas being referenced here, to be clear, this bill is a gas-only leasing bill and would only permit access to the gas resources. Only from the unrestricted surface areas, but we are not talking about access to oil with the passage of this bill. So thank you for the opportunity to comment as well.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Appreciate that. Representative Price Tompkins, is that complete your question? Or
just I guess, a comment and maybe more for the division to chew on going forward. I mean, all those provisos make sense, not looking for, like, you know, a highly specific, you know, cost, like, you know, down to the barrel or down to the cent. But, I mean, there's probably some sense of the scope and size of the resource. There's some industry interest. That's the reason we're considering this bill. And just, like, getting some very, like, rough sense of, like, what kind of development potential or oil and gas or gas extraction potential exists would be helpful just to contextualize this.
So if that's a possibility from the department, we'd appreciate if you got that back to us and we distribute that to all members.
Absolutely. We can look into that. I get the one other thing I might add on that point is that, you know, this would just open up more land that has interest from industry in gas production, which there is the added benefit that's a bit intangible, but that's increased gas production to supply the utilities in South Central Alaska. And so just in the past, we've had a situation where we have had a production shortage, and keeping that gas supply replaced as it's consumed is extremely important to the utilities. And so beyond the direct revenue to the state, the benefit of increased gas production results in energy security for South Central Alaska.
Let's go to Representative McCabe and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. So to answer your question, directional drilling has been around since the mid-80s, maybe longer. It's been highly refined since then. I have a brother that owned a drilling company for a while. He's no longer in that. Full disclosure, he used it in many other states as a, and he was a core driller, so he was looking for minerals and looking for gas and that sort of thing. They used it in many other states to get underneath the wetlands so they didn't disturb the wetlands. It was specifically so that they did not create a problem with wetlands or lakes or, it wasn't necessarily the closed areas, but, companies would make a choice to move their rigs so that they weren't impacting wetlands or habitat or anything and directional drill, to get underneath them. So, I asked him if there were any pitfalls or any big major accidents that he knew of, and he said no. He said it's actually really safe and really well refined, and it's something that we as a state might ought to consider. Not just for this, but we have lots and lots of areas that are we wouldn't want a drill rig in. I get that. I mean, I'm an Alaskan. I love the pristine beauty, but we also have a necessity to heat our homes and fuel our cars and that sort of thing, so we have to strike a balance. And maybe this is a partial answer. I don't know, but I wanted to bring that up. It would be good to know in this particular area how far down they would have to go before they set the blocker and to go into the field, and how far out they would have to go underneath the ocean.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I don't have specifics on the horizons that they would be exploiting. I can point the committee to an analogous operation that's occurring just north of this area to demonstrate kind of some of the technology that's being implemented on the horizontal drilling front, and speak to their track record. The Cosmopolitan unit, which is about I think it's 4 miles north of Anchor Point there, that's accessed entirely onshore, and I have it on the map on the screen here. You can see the area with the scale here. So the green location here is the pad where the drilling rig drills the wells from, and then each of these red dots out here in the inlet, as you can see, 3 to 4 miles offshore, are the various openings in that wellbore. So that there's multiple horizons that possibly could be exploited. I don't know the exact depths of those, and they're yet to be explored, and maybe considered trade secrets or confidential geologic information by the operators. But in any case, this is being done in the vicinity, so just north, and it's being done safely, and it's being done to add to that gas supply in Cook Inlet. So I can speak to the operations being conducted within the state, and unfortunately, I can't speak to the exact horizons.
So it's safe to say that you said earlier that there's going to be a public process, there's going to be public comment, and there will be permitting, obviously, and we should know or have some idea what those horizons are, so that the public can properly comment. I mean, if you're going to kind of go at an angle right at the shoreline, might be a problem for the public, but if you're going to go down 10,000 feet before you head sideways a little bit, maybe not so much, and it would be extremely helpful if we had that kind of horizon for the public to understand that it may how much impact it's actually going to have or could possibly have. If you're 10,000 feet down or 5,000 feet down underneath the seabed, maybe not so much, but
sure. Yeah, and I can speak to the public process for the leasing process, and I believe Commissioner Seamount would be able to speak to the public process for the drilling permit. So the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, they regulate the technical side of the drilling. They issue the drilling permits. They tell the operator, how much flow they can allow through their well bore, where they can open their wells, that sort of thing. So the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission should be able to speak to the public process involved in permitting those wells. As far as the leasing process goes, if this bill were to pass, the Division of Oil and Gas would still have to analyze whether to issue leases in this area. We would have to take our best interest finding decision that we have promulgated for Cook Inlet. And this area would likely then be added to that best interest finding. And that would involve an entire update to that decision, which would include public comment. We would look at the horizons, the likelihood of the development occurring and the type of development occurring. And we would look at the whole suite of things that we do look at in those findings. And we can share our Cook Inlet finding with you so that you can see the breadth of it. But it's very extensive. So on the leasing side, there'd be a very large public process and an opportunity for the public to weigh in. On the drilling side, I would defer to the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to speak to that public process.
Commissioner Seamount, do you have anything you'd like to add about the public process for the drilling permits?
Madam Chair Tarr, what we do would probably take up quite a bit of time for presentation, but I'll try to summarize it. For as far as the public process is concerned, when it comes to drilling permits, by the time it gets to that, the public process has already been taken care of by other agencies. Then we get the drilling permit after it's gone through the public process, and we ensure that the well bores are constructed so that underground sources of drinking water are not impacted negatively, that relative rights are considered and taken care of, which is a big part of Mr. O'Quinn's presentation today. That we've got a number of ways to take care of relative rights, and probably the last resort would be the compulsory unitization, which has been discussed already. But we also ensure that production will be enhanced, and that there will be minimized almost no waste of resources. And in this case, it would be waste of gas. So that's a really brave commentary of what we do.
Thank you so much. Representative McCabe, do you have any follow-up?
No, ma'am. Thank you so much. Thanks for your indulgence. I appreciate it.
Of course. I think Representative Ortiz has another question, and I didn't see a hand from Rep. Rance or Story, but I just want to make sure I haven't missed you. Did I miss you? Okay. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up, and thank you for that answer that you provided. It was helpful. I appreciate that. It was just described as new technology, so I just didn't know how new it was. So anyway, as this is a quick follow-up, you mentioned that if this were to be passed and if that this area were to be developed to access the natural gas, it would work to support the need for gas in the Cook Inlet area. Can you give me a little update as to, you know, I don't follow that from year to year to year. Are we looking at a bleak horizon if we don't do some more development in terms of having continued access to natural gas in the existing resources? Are we seeing that unless we do something for further development, we're going to run out of natural gas for the Cook Inlet area?
So I can't speak to the remaining reserves, and perhaps Sean or Haley might weigh in for Cook Inlet, but I can speak to the production percentages. So we're down almost 10% December 21 from December 2020. The industry, the utilities have taken steps to kind of mitigate things. They've integrated more storage, underground natural gas storage, to kind of buffer supply, produce more during the summer, store it, send it off to market in the wintertime when there's a greater market for it. So there are things that the industry has done since the gas shortages of the 2010 era. But maybe Sean or Haley can speak to reserves in Cook Inlet and gas reserves and what the forecast for that may be.
Hi, yes, through the chair, for the record again, this is Haley Payne, Deputy Director for the Division of Oil and Gas. I think Mr. O'Quinn did an excellent job sort of summarizing in general what we see in the year over year sort of declines that our field can be expected to receive. For the committee's reference, we do have a study that we put out in 2018 that took a look at Cook Inlet and discussed some of the natural gas aspects there, what we have going on in existing fields. And I'd be happy to, as a follow-up, share the link to that study, which may be able to provide a little bit more detail. As indicated by Mr. O'Quinn, I don't have any sort of date certain, as obviously exploration activities continue to move that target. And again, through the advent of natural gas storage fields, we've really been able to advance in terms of our ability to prepare for the cold snap like we have this winter. But yes, I'd be happy to share that study with you for reference so that you may get a better preference of everything that we have on the record regarding South Central gas supply.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Representative Vance, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be honest, this bill gives me great consternation. This is directly in my backyard. And I have heard from the public, from my constituents about this, and seeing the the area that is closed to oil and gas. I see that you're just at the bill request, just a specific township area, just a small carve out. But the question that my community is going to have is, what's next? And I know that you are probably not in the position to answer that directly, but that's their concern, is they specifically, I believe 30 years ago, passed this section to close Kachemak Bay to oil and gas development to protect everything in Kachemak Bay. And if we were to pass this piece of legislation with no no idea of what the net positive to the state would be, so that we could continue funding important state services, the bigger question is, why? Why should we expedite this process when the state has another avenue to seek resolve in this, when it sounds like the Oil and Gas Commission has a more extensive look and a greater public process? Can you give my district a reason why this bill is a much better process than the one that's already in place with the Oil and Gas Commission?
Sure. I'll take a stab at that, Representative Vance, through the chair. The big takeaway is that, yes, there is a process where the state could protect its correlative rights by integrating this land through a compulsory unit through the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. However, that process is not commonly utilized. I think, as Commissioner Seamount mentioned, it's kind of a last step toward if there's nothing else that can be done. That being said, we have demonstrated, gas reserves are being used. They're not being replaced as quickly as they're being used. And there is a need, there is a market for this gas, a local market for this gas. And by giving the operators a certain contractual agreement that has specific requirements for mitigation, among other things, economic requirements, mitigation requirements, term to develop, that sort of thing. It gives them certainty to invest capital to develop that resource, which is used by everyone in South Central Alaska. Homer Electric Association is a very big customer of the gas producers in Cook Inlet. And then, recognizing that this is a special area. The division knows that. I know that as a recreationalist. We have offered in this bill also an amendment to, or a provision to basically account for the royalties that come from these specific lands, to report that to the legislature each year. In order for the legislature to specifically appropriate that money toward renewable energy, which helps the state move away from its reliance on hydrocarbon development. So as far as the need for it, yes, there is a process currently in place, but it's burdensome. It's a bit of a wild card for the state. It's a bit of a wild card for the operators, and it's a bit of a wild card for the general public. Whereas if we have this lease process where the state says, we think this is in the best interest of the state. Public, what do you think? And we give the public an opportunity to weigh in. They can comment on the mitigation measures. They can comment on the specific acreage that we are offering for lease. And then they have an administrative process with the state to work through. And then once we've kind of resolved those concerns and we reach that best interest finding that integrates all of that various input, the science, the public commentary, and other things that we consider in those best interest findings, we can then enter into these contracts that are in compliance with that best interest finding, as opposed to the operator saying, I'm going to produce this gas. We think this is about how much is coming from your land. We're going to have a public hearing about it and allocate the resource to you, however that falls out in that public hearing. It really takes away a lot of the public input, actually, because the company can still drill. They just can't get that wellbore just a little bit under that line or into that area. So I think that by passing this, it allows us to lease that land. And before we can lease that land, we have to go to the public and we have to get that input. And so I think that answers your question, that this is how we can, this is why, because it gives a lot more certainty to all the stakeholders. And I think the advantages of it are that the public process for leasing this land is a lot more robust than the oil and gas conservation compulsory unitization process.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. In our previous hearings, if I remember correctly, if this bill does not pass, the state is essentially forced to go through that process. Is that accurate?
If the division is looking at the development and we see that our state lands are being drained, then we would, as the proprietary sort of keeper of those property rights for the state, we would most likely have to go to the AOGCC. Yeah. Yes.
Additional follow-up? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And who is receiving the revenue from that right now?
These lands aren't being drained right now. So there are two wells. There's the CBU-8 and the CBU-9 that are producing. Those have been studied by the division, and they're being produced some from state land, some from private land, and the proceeds from those wells are being divided in the proportion that's of the ownership of the area that's draining. It's not currently draining areas in Kachemak Bay. The idea is, though, that there is a gas resource in that area, and more exploration will likely take place, and so we want to make that available to the operator, so that we have this certainty of knowing what the state's percentage interest in that will be, and the operator does too. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. I have a question. I'm just responding to some of the comments we've received by emails. And so, talking about the public process, there was a public process that created the Kachemak Bay Critical Habitat Area. And so, how would the department respond to the opposition saying, by basically, if this goes forward, we're ignoring the public, that was heavily involved and participated in the process that created this area with the restriction on oil and gas development. So I think that's kind of the struggle here, is like previously the public had said this. And so at least for some people who still live in the area and were part of that, they're saying, we've already said, we're not interested. So they don't want to have to go through another public process because the law has changed and now there's leasing available. So I'm not, too familiar with that. Something I would like to study up on and understand a little bit more about. I know the area is very special, but, the specifics of what we're trying to accomplish by having it be a critical habitat area. But there was a public process for that, too.
Sure. So I think that historically the closure area came out of an incident. There was a drilling rig, I believe, that got stuck. And it was, I don't know that there was any much of an environmental impact, but it just kind of raised a lot of alarm for the public in that area and around the state, frankly, so much so that a law was passed to prevent this, as you can see. And so I think that the biggest takeaway I could offer is that, we are not seeking to materially change the status quo. There is oil and gas drilling taking place. The surface impacts are happening right now in Anchor Point. They won't be materially increased. This just basically allows the state to, that certainty of the contract, of the lease contract, to know how that revenue gets allocated. That being said, if we were to offer this land for lease, we would have to reach that best interest finding process. And we know that there was a lot of public input that went into the drafting of that legislation prior to it being passed to close the Kachemak Bay area. But we have put in place for the rest of Cook Inlet, as far as surface operations go, very extensive mitigation measures. And I think these are what apply now to those parcels in Anchor Point that are currently being impacted by surface operations. And I would just say that we're not materially changing the effect of the closure law. We are leaving in place the restrictions that prevent the impacts that were contemplated by the passage of that law. And so that's probably the best answer I have to that. Other than that, the restrictions that are in place for surface operations are very extensive and are in place now and affect what is currently happening on the ground in Anchor Point just outside of this area. And that's where these operations would continue to take place.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, and thank you for all the good questions that were asked today, fellow committee members. So I was wondering, so if this bill does not pass, could you go over again the status quo? You're saying drilling is taking place now, and resources are coming through those means, and you're just saying there'll be lost opportunity for the state to go underneath the bill. If you could outline those, I would find that helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Story through the chair. I have the map up on the screen. So you see the map on the right, there's the word Seaview and a blue outline around it. That's the Seaview unit. The green square below the word Seaview is where the drilling rig has been set up. I don't believe it's currently stacked and drilling right now, but that is where the drilling rig has been set up. And then the red dots below Seaview are the two wells that have been drilled. So basically, these two wells are producing from both state and private lands in this area. The operations have occurred. And then right now it's basically a pipe coming out of the ground with gas flowing through that pipe to another pipe that goes to a power plant or goes to a home or et cetera. So basically what this would allow is, maybe from this green area that's just below the word Seaview there, or maybe from another one closer to shore within the requirements of the mitigation measures presented in the lease form. The operator might be able to drill beneath the blue hatched area, but it would be the same kind of surface impacts that we've seen for these two wells that have currently been drilled, if that makes sense. So, for the first month or two while they're drilling the well, there's a machine that's drilling into the earth. And then once they've reached the place that they need to get to, the drill rig goes away. And the wells on production and the gas flows generally of its own pressure. Sometimes there's a compressor involved, and there are permit standards for compressors and noise mitigation and that sort of thing as well. So as far as the current impacts are, that's what they would be. This might allow additional wells to be drilled, but generally there's that kind of that initial, I'll call it the more disruptive phase, where you have the actual drilling operations taking place. Once the well's completed, it's generally on production. Every few years, they may come in and do some work over on it to clean it up, enhance the production in some way. But in general, a gas well is a pretty unobtrusive object. It's a pipe coming out of the ground. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Representative McCabe?
So I think what this bill contemplates, or what we are discussing, is when the people in Rep. Vance's district, or when the state decided that this Blue Cross Hatch area was off limits for drilling, now we want to say, or we want to know, is it just a surface area? Is that all we care about is drill rigs on the top and their interface where there might be some leakage? Or is it possible to go down? How far down does this Blue Cross Hatch area go? Does it go 20,000 feet? Does it go 30,000 feet? Does it go down to the core of the earth? So it seems to me that's what we're trying to figure out, is how far down do we need to go before we can go sideways and still comply with what the people wanted, which was this area off limits, and comply with what we know we need eventually, which is a certain amount of gas to heat our homes. So it seems to me that all this talking could have been reduced to that much sentences. I don't know.
That was a good summary. I agree. That was a good summary. I don't know if anybody else has any comments. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Rep. McCabe. I can assure you that the same people who worked hard to pass the restriction 30 years ago are the same people who say no subsea directional drilling. No way, no how. And they're very passionate about this. And I'm willing to have a conversation and ask the question if that is acceptable, but I have heard from the people who are greatly engaged in this that they're not comfortable with the idea. The reason that they originally passed the law was to say, no, you have a lot of other areas to do the drilling, but stay out of Kachemak Bay. And I do not think that they've changed their mind in the last 30 years. I'm willing to ask the question because this is obviously not impacting the waters. But as far as I know, they don't believe that. Mm-hmm. Because just a couple years ago, there was north of Anchor Point was a minor gas leak into the Cook Inlet. That it was minor, but nonetheless, it happened. And that's something that greatly disturbs people in the area, that, you know, we have these big promises that there's going to be zero impact. And we know that things happen. And they say, well, we at least don't want it to happen in Kachemak Bay. So, again, I'll ask the question, but I do not foresee that the people who originally passed this have changed their mind.
Well, hence,
thank you. And I apologize because it's 12 o'clock. And so I know other folks, you know, might have other commitments. So I think we're going to have to leave it there today. But the point of today was to try and get as many questions answered as possible in that refresher. So we'll, you know, be in touch if we need to continue in a Q&A. If there's more exploration of this topic, we can certainly do that. So again, no amendment deadline or anything. Let's hit the pause button and make sure we get everybody's questions answered, and then we'll evaluate. Thank you so much, Mr. O'Quinn, and thank you to your colleagues for joining us today and being able to answer so many of our questions. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So at 12:01 p.m., this meeting is adjourned.
Madam Chair.